Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. I am Kim Colton, your host. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. Or you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And tonight I'd like to introduce my co-host for this evening. Her name is Delilah Jones from Imagine Publicity at imaginepublicity.com. Delilah, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Oh, Kim, I'm all excited, really. It's fun to be here with you. We've done some shows in the past, and, you know, I think our guest, Professor Bond, is going to really be full of information for all of the crime buffs out there who listen to the show on a regular basis. They're going to love him.
They're going to love it. And let me tell you a little bit about Professor Scott Bond. He is a professor of criminology at Drew University, media expert and analyst, public speaker and author. He is an expert on criminal behavior and the motivations of criminals. He offers insights into various types of crime, including white-collar, state crime, bullying, domestic violence, sexual assault, and serial homicide. His expert commentary frequently appears in the popular news media. Professor Bond recently spent 5 enlightening hours with David Berkowitz, the man whose pseudonym, Son of Sam, has become synonymous with evil. He stated, "David gave me a rare one-on-one interview that I will not soon forget." Welcome, Professor Scott Bond, to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Kim and Delilah. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Professor, you have a book coming out called Why We Love Serial Killers. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, thank you very much for the question. And the title of it is Why We Love Serial Killers, and it's slated for release actually next summer, about this time next year, from Skyhorse Press. And so I'm very excited about that. And I recognize that the title is going to raise some controversy and raise some eyebrows. And because the notion of loving a serial killer is, you know, seems very contradictory. But it occurred to me that there really is a fascination out there and a passion among many people for the dark side of life and terrible deeds, and including the acts of serial killers, terrible people such as Jeffrey Dahmer and David Berkowitz and Ted Bundy and others. And it occurred to me as well, because of my media background, that the news media and law enforcement and the public as well collectively transform these individuals into almost a sort of like morbid celebrities, and they become pop culture icons. I mean, none other than Jack the Ripper, probably the most notorious of all, is larger than life. He take on mythical proportions, even though he was never even identified, and this is his 125th anniversary of his murders this year, Jack the Ripper, and we're still talking about him. So there's this incredible fascination, and I thought I would explore it, you know, why people are fascinated with serial killers.
I think it's interesting that you've been in touch with serial killers, the ones that we know, the ones that we hear about on the news, like David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, and BTK, Dennis Rader. Have you ever interviewed or have you ever contacted or been in contact with any of the victims and seen, you know, what their opinions or what their feelings are from that end of the spectrum?
Or their families? Right.
At this point, I have not spoken to them directly, but I have talked to both Dennis Rader and David Berkowitz about their own experiences with the victims' families and whether or not they've reached out, because, as you know, David Berkowitz claims to be very remorseful and is a born-again Christian and has been for a number of years in prison. And he has been in touch with at least the Moskowitz family the mother of Stacy Moskowitz, who was one of his victims. And before she died, she actually wrote a letter to David Berkowitz forgiving him for his terrible, terrible crime. So, you know, there is, you know, some indication of, you know, of remorse there. But your point is well taken. You know, I was just talking to a colleague of mine, said that it's rather tragic that the killers themselves are household names, Son of Sam, the Boston Strangler, Jack the Ripper, and yet we don't know the names of the victims. And that is a sort of a terrible paradox of all of this. So it's a good point, Delilah.
We see that quite often. And I'm sorry, Kim, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Professor, I was just wondering, how long did it take you in corresponding with David Berkowitz to finally get that interview? And what was it like? I can't imagine what, just even the correspondence in and of itself. You are a professor of sociology, so that is a subject that is near and dear to my heart. And you have to understand that in order to get close or to get the ultimate interview with this person. And it just must have been wonderful to you. I mean, how did you feel when you finally, how long did it take to get the interview? And then how did you feel when you finally were sitting there? Must have been fascinating.
Absolutely. And those are both really terrific questions. And I should back up and even explain to the audience why I reached out to Berkowitz and Rader to begin with. As I began thinking about this book, why we love serial killers, that I can talk to the police, I can talk to news reporters who may have been involved in these cases, I can talk to the public in order to figure out the fascination and get insights. But why not go to the individuals themselves who were the perpetrators and try to get their take on the public's fascination with them? And so I specifically selected two individuals, two serial killers who gave themselves their brand name. Son of Sam was coined by David Berkowitz, and BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill, was coined by Dennis Rader. They both enjoyed playing cat and mouse with law enforcement and the media, and they loved the public attention. So I figured, why not go directly to the source and see what I could find out? And I began writing to both of them, and I wrote to them. I have been writing to them for now almost 3 years, in fact. And I suspected that they might both be interested in corresponding with me, but for very different reasons. I knew that David Berkowitz was a born-again Christian, and I thought that he might be intrigued by the prospect of a professor who's writing a book and interested in his story. So he responded very quickly. And on the other hand, Rader, BTK, responded, as I anticipated, simply because he's an incredible narcissist and he's the most interesting guy he knows. And so he was more than happy to tell me all about his behavior and his experiences. Not because he's remorseful, simply because he's in many ways bragging about how he was able to get away with killing for almost 30 years. So for very different reasons, they were both willing to engage with me. But the Berkowitz interview took probably from the time that I asked him to get together, it probably took about 6 months. And the reason it took that long is, first of all, David's not going anywhere. He's there in a maximum security prison up in the Catskills, New York, at Sullivan Correctional Facility. So he's not going anywhere. And with his faith in God now and his relationship as he sees it with God. He prayed on it, and he wanted the time to be right. And the time finally manifested itself this past March, and I went up there and spent nearly 5 hours with him. And so I was exhilarated. I was very exhilarated that I was had this opportunity, and I knew that he is in general population now. He circulates in the general population there at Sullivan Correctional Facility, so he's not in solitary confinement or anything like that. He's actually considered a model prisoner, so I knew that we would be able to meet in somewhat of an open setting, which we did in essentially the canteen, or almost like a cafeteria for visitors and family members at Sullivan Correctional Facility. And so I was excited, I guess is the way that I would put it. I was not really fearful in any way. I was excited and had a lot of a sense of anticipation. And after corresponding for so long with him, I was really looking forward to it. But the most intimidating part of the entire experience was really seeing this stone fortress facility from the outside, and then dealing with the administration of the prison, who are absolutely no nonsense, and were not particularly impressed by the fact that I'm a college professor doing an interview for a book.
Right.
And
Sullivan
is
known as the fortress.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Sullivan Correctional Facility is a maximum security prison, and it is known for its inmates who typically are either lifers who are there for murder, and or individuals who have severe mental and physical disabilities. And so there were a lot of individuals there who, to the lay person, you would think that they were insane, but to law enforcement and the criminal justice system, they are not, simply because they did not know, or excuse me, they knew the difference between right and wrong when they committed their crimes. But to you and me, many of them would seem to be, quite ill, mentally ill. And now David Berkowitz is the only inmate, and he's been doing this for some years now, where he serves as a peer mentor for many of these other prisoners who have physical and mental handicaps. He's a spiritual advisor. He reads the Bible with them. He helps them with mobility. He helps them to read and write letters. And so he's somewhat of a surrogate and a helper for these other inmates. And this is part of what he now believes is his service to God. He had what he described to me as a white light experience, or a spiritual transformation, back in 1987, so it's been quite a while now, where he said that he felt the hand of God on him and transformed him from an evil person into a Christian. And since then, his modus operandi, if you will, has been to try to serve and give back to God and humanity in any way he can behind bars.
Well, that brings me to a question, Scott. In a setting like that, that you've described, the type of prisoners that are there and the kind of the attitude of the prison guards and so forth, what type of programs are there available for these prisoners, or is there anything as far as, you know, mental health help? Is David Berkowitz the only one who is serving them spiritually, or do they have other programs within that prison system that deals with the other prisoners as well?
Well, there is a special unit for the prisoners who have the most severe disabilities, and that's where David is a helper or provides service, and he is the only prisoner who is allowed to do that. There are other professionals there, of course, who deal with their needs. There is a chaplain, of course, a prison chaplain, And Chaplin actually allows David to lead prayer, and he even sometimes offers some words and some service or sermon as a an assistant to the chaplain. But this is a very Spartan environment. There's not a lot there, and so these prisoners are, you know, in many ways very much on their own, and David gives them a lot of help. You know, many of them just are illiterate or have difficulty writing because of physical handicaps, and so he helps them with letters and, you know, and so forth. But this is not social work that's going on here. This is a stone-cold, hardcore prison, so there are not many amenities at all. And as I said, the administrators are really no nonsense. I had difficulty even getting a piece of paper in just to take notes on. I was told that I would be allowed to, well, I sat with David to take notes, and I was literally given one piece of paper to write on for an entire 4.5-hour period while I was there. So needless to say, I had to take very, very, very small notes on that one piece of paper.
Tiny writing.
Yeah, exactly.
Get it all. Well, and, you know, and it's interesting to me, and I'm sure to the listeners as well, because not too many people are granted these types of visits, are they? I mean, how difficult was it for you to, I know, you know, Berkowitz welcomed you, but how difficult was it to get through the system to be able to visit with him?
Well, the corresponding with these prisoners is much easier than one might think. Any prisoner, whether it's Dennis Rader or David Berkowitz or just a common, you know, a more common criminal, has a number, has a prisoner number. And so if you know where they're locked up and you can find out their prison number, you can write to them directly. It's up to them whether or not they choose to respond. They're not obligated in any way to respond. So when I wrote these letters initially, my first letters to David and to Dennis, I had no way of knowing whether they would respond to me, and although I suspected that they might, as I said, for different reasons. And I've written to other serial killers. I've written to Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer. I've written to Joel Rifkin, who killed 17 prostitutes here in New York. I've written to Ed Kemper. Those individuals did not respond to me for, I could speculate a number of reasons, but, mm-hmm. You know, I was so pleased when I did get a response from these two, because if I had a wish list and said, who would you most like to correspond with, it would have been David Berkowitz and Dennis Rader, because they're such different individuals, such incredibly different individuals. And so the answer to your question, Delilah, it was easy to correspond, and it was ultimately up to David Berkowitz also whether he would see me, because he has, as I said, he's in general population now. He's not locked up in solitary confinement, as is Dennis Rader, BTK, out in Kansas. Berkowitz is in general population, so you can visit him just as you could visit, again, a more common prisoner, but it's up to him. He has to be willing to see you.
So the prison system itself doesn't really, I'm assuming they don't do background checks and things like that on who's coming to visit these people. So you didn't to go through any process?
I didn't have to go through that process, but what I did have to go through was a tremendous amount of scrutiny on the day that I arrived there, going through a metal detector. They photocopied my driver's license. I had to fill out a number of forms. So they had everything. You know, they had you know, my personal background as well as my identification. So it was quite a bit of scrutiny to get through the metal detector and into the prison itself.
Kim, how are you doing with your voice?
I'm doing pretty good. I was wondering, why do people seem to love serial killers? Have women who flock to the, what were those two kids who killed their parents? I forget now.
Oh, the Menendez brothers.
The Menendez brothers.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, you had women flocking to them to, you know, have a relationship of whatever means that would be. I mean, why do people seem to love serial killers? It's kind of weird.
Well, that's absolutely true, and that gets to the heart of my book. So thank you for asking the question. And, you know, people love killers at different levels. There are people who, and I would put myself in this category, who are simply fascinated by it and are interested in reading about it and finding out the motivations of the killers and getting into the more psychological aspects of it and the criminal behavior, the motivations for the criminal behavior. But there are other people who take it to a much greater extreme, and there are people who become literally fans and even groupies of serial killers, follow them around, and there are people who collect so-called murderabilia, which are the artifacts and mementos and memorabilia of serial killers. People, believe it or not, collect locks of hair from Charles Manson and Ted Bundy John Wayne Gacy.
His paintings.
Yep. There are his paintings of Pogo the Clown. For those of your listeners who may be familiar, his alter ego, John Wayne Gacy, was called the Killer Clown, and he had an alter ego, Pogo, which was a clown that he dressed up as to visit children's hospitals, which is pretty creepy. But anyway, while he was in prison, he began painting, and he was actually pretty good at it. And his paintings of Pogo the Clown now go for in the neighborhood of $20,000 to $25,000 each. And there are websites,
whoa,
including MurderAuction.com is an example, and SerialKillersInc.net, where one can purchase these kinds of items on auction. And there are people who do it and spend big money for these kind of things. So there are people who are rabid fans, and that's one level. And I actually have a chapter in my book about this collecting phenomenon, collecting of murderabilia. And then there are also people who take it yet even a step further and become the groupies, lovers, and sometimes spouses of serial killers. Your listeners may be aware that just a couple of weeks ago now, Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, died in prison. He's been sitting on death row for decades, and he finally died, actually, of natural causes, liver failure, a couple of weeks ago. And back in the mid-90s, he married one of his groupies. And this groupie, her name was Doreen Loy, was actually a freelance journalist who had written him something like 75 letters and was just totally obsessed with him, and they became married. So she is now Mrs. Ramirez and of the late Richard Ramirez. She's the widow.
It's amazing. Isn't it interesting that the you know, talking about the murderabilia and making money off of convicted killers' things, and then we have the Son of Sam laws that they cannot profit from it. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And this is also, I write about this in my book as well, that there's two sets of laws. There's the Son of Sam laws, and then there are also so-called notoriety for profit laws. And they really address two separate things. The Son of Sam laws are to prohibit felons from benefiting financially from expressive works, essentially stories and books and movies and so forth about their criminal lives. And the reason these came out or came into play, there's a federal Son of Sam law, and there are approximately 40 states that have Son of Sam laws. And the reason they're called Son of Sam laws is because David Berkowitz, back in 1977, was actually offered quite a bit of money when he first went to Attica for his life story. And the state of New York intervened and said, there's no way we're going to allow this to happen. And so that was the genesis or the origin of these Son of Sam laws. Now, artifacts, things like murderabilia, clothing and clippings of hair and so forth of serial killers and their paintings wouldn't fall under that because they're not expressive works, they're not stories and so forth. But nevertheless, serial killers and other convicted felons cannot benefit financially from the sale of that kind of stuff either. So what happens is they typically get in the hands of a third party, and often there are these brokers or these dealers who operate these websites like SerialKillersInc.net, and they are the ones who are selling and gaining a profit from these things. Now, that's not illegal. It's not if you own something that is interesting and compelling to a serial killer fan, and as long as you are not a criminal and you simply possess it, you have the right to sell it. And so they are not breaking the law by doing these things. Now, there are still many people who are opposed, violently opposed to the selling of this merchandise and profiteering from murder and tragedy, but that's a different story. That's the morality side of it. But the victims' families of serial killers and a number of other advocates, victim advocates, are very much opposed to these sorts of things. But nevertheless, these items remain, and they go for big money. And among people I've talked to, people who do this collecting, there's this fascination with death and the macabre. And by collecting something that maybe once was held by Dennis Rader or Richard Ramirez, it gets you as close as possible to horror while remaining safe yourself. You can get close to the flame without getting burned, so you can almost vicariously participate in these crimes without actually doing so and putting yourself at risk or breaking the law. So it's almost like an adrenaline rush for people who collect these things, I think is the way that I would describe it. And in the case of someone like Doreen Ramirez, who became obsessed with Richard and married him while he was literally sitting on death row, imagine that. I mean, imagine marrying a horrific serial killer, one of the worst of all time, while he's sitting waiting to be executed on death row and marrying him. And I think in her case, she was riveted by his almost like a satanic presence. He was almost like this larger than life presence, sort of like Charles Manson, and he had groupies as well. And some of these individuals just draw people to them, and I think these are people who typically have low self-esteem and are looking to affix themselves to something almost mythical or larger than life. And maybe at another level, it's also the bad boy syndrome. It's Richard Ramirez was the ultimate bad boy who needed to be fixed by someone, and perhaps Doreen thought that she was the woman for the job. I don't know, but that may play into this as well.
And that's a whole other psychological drama there.
It certainly is. It certainly is. But my book, although I do address some of these more extreme aspects of the fascination and some of these more extreme things like collecting murderabilia and the groupie phenomenon and so forth, my book is really more for the average person who simply is interested in the macabre and interested in serial killers generally, and wants to explore that fascination and explore the public's fascination with it. And so I've talked to a lot of people. I've talked to police officers. I've talked to journalists who covered many of the famous cases. I've talked to simply members of the public who themselves claim to be serial killer fans. And I'm working on a chapter right now for my book, which is I call the title of it is Why We Love Serial Killers, the Making of the Monsters. And if you'll allow me, I'd like to read a paragraph from it that that really talks directly to this obsession that, that many people have. And would that be all right if I just read a paragraph from the book?
It'd be great. Yeah, please.
Okay.
Do.
Okay. So here, this is fresh off the press from my book. The public's fascination or obsession with serial killers is multifaceted and complex. Serial killers are so extreme in their brutality and so seemingly unnatural that we are riveted by them. We love the violence, but we cannot comprehend it, although we are compelled to. They excite us much like terrible traffic accidents or natural disasters. We cannot keep from watching the tragedies unfold before us. Serial killers are scary predators that thrill us, much like tigers, lions, and snakes at the zoo. Serial killers have a visceral appeal, similar to roller coasters and monster movies. They give us a rush of adrenaline and are a source of popcorn entertainment for many of us. By following their crimes in the news media, we can also play armchair detective and see if we can figure out who done it before the authorities catch the actual perpetrator. Perhaps most significantly, as fixtures in our popular culture, serial killers allow us to experience horror in a controlled environment and fly close to the flame without getting burned.
Oh, that's very true and quite interesting. And, you know, what do you think about it? I know online there's just so many sites now which deal with solving crimes, and you have millions of armchair detectives and armchair sleuths who try to put a lot of different clues together and come up with solutions or try to solve the crime. How do you feel about that, and do you think they're helpful, hurtful? What do you think?
Well, you know, that gets to the, you know, playing armchair detective, and I think a lot of us do love to do that, myself included. I'm a criminologist, so I love that. And a good friend of mine, whose name is Dave Carbone, and he is a retired NYPD homicide detective who I interviewed for my book, I asked him, I said, you know, what is the appeal? And he said that he believes that the appeal for the average person with serial killers, and for that matter, crime in general, particularly violent crime, is the same as for him as a former professional. And he gave me a great quote from my book, Delilah. He said, the why is the wow. And when he says why, what he's referring to, the why that he refers to there, is the motivation. And he said as a former homicide detective, he was always riveted by and driven to understand the motivation of his prey. And he believes that the general public, when we sit back and watch these stories unfold in the news, it's very much the same thing for us. We're driven to know the why. And I can certainly, as a criminologist, can attest to that. I'm very, very interested in the motivation. And the problem, of course, with technology the way it is now is that we frequently have rumors and misinformation that's circulated through, you know, various social media, through Twitter, through Facebook and through text messaging and so forth. And so rumors become rampant, and rumors can become reality to the extent that people believe them. So sometimes I think the social media, even though it can be useful in some ways, can also get in the way of justice. And one of our rights and the Bill of Rights amendment to the Constitution guarantees a fair trial and a speedy trial. But at the time that our forefathers were writing those things, they could never have anticipated media to the extent that it exists now. And so when you have a trial like the one that's going on as we speak with George Zimmerman, it is a circus. It's an absolute media circus, and everyone is weighing in. And it's almost impossible, unless you completely sequester a jury, as they have done in this case, to ensure anything sort of coming close to fairness and objectivity. So, go ahead.
That goes into the question of what do you feel that the media is doing as far as, you know, not only what you just described, bringing a lot of facts, so-called facts, out before they're even proven facts, and causing a lot of confusion among the public, to speak. But what about the media's role in creating heroes out of some of the dregs of the earth that have committed some of the worst heinous crimes we can even think of? But yet, is the media, like, and then we come out with shows like Dexter and The Killing and a couple of the other ones that are out now that are just almost too real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's already a Jodi Arias movie out. I don't know if you were aware of that, but it just aired the other night on I'm not sure if it was Lifetime or one of these networks. And so she hasn't even been formally sentenced yet. And we know she's been found guilty of first-degree murder with aggravating circumstances, but we don't even know her sentence, and there's already the movie of the week out. So the media are a machine, and they're a for-profit machine, and nothing sells like sex and violence. So once you have a story such as the Jodi Arias story, which was just fraught with sex and violence, it's a natural, and they're going to pick up on it. And these things turn very bad people, you know, into sort of pop culture icons, and that is a side effect and a negative side effect of this 24/7 media society and marketplace that we have, where everything is reduced to a commodity. And Jodi Arias is now a commodity. The Son of Sam is a commodity. And Dennis Rader, BTK, is a commodity. And people make money off of it. And that's simply the society that we live in. And but can it be damaging to the justice system? Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I can point to one instance where I think pretrial publicity and journalistic involvement and the celebrity status of a person probably got in the way of justice, and that was the Kobe Bryant incident some years ago that you may recall. Kobe Bryant, yeah. The big-time basketball player, one of the greatest basketball players of all time, but also you know, an extremely wealthy, powerful individual as a celebrity, was charged with sexually assaulting a concierge at a hotel in Colorado. And before it ever made it into court, there were all these so-called leaks indicating that she was promiscuous, indicating that she was mentally unstable, indicating that she had numerous lovers. And guess what? The charges were dropped. And I wouldn't be surprised also if some money exchanged hands along the way. So depending who you are, you can also, you know, buy your own justice as well.
Oh, no doubt. Well, and if we have O.J. Simpson to fall back on as well, I think, you know, with the information age in its infancy, the O.J. Simpson trial was kind of the beginning of all of this.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It was
watching it all live, and then the internet comes about, and we have live information. So it's just a total information overload. And I agree with you. I think in some cases it is getting in the way of justice. It's not, you know, whether we feel one way or another about a person's guilt or innocence, they still are entitled to that trial, and they're still entitled to justice brought about through our system the way it is. We might not like it, but that's what we have to work with right now. And I can't imagine in a lot of these high-profile cases like Casey Anthony or Drew Peterson or now Jody Arias and Zimmerman, how these juries cannot be somehow tainted in a way before these trials even begin, because they would have to be living in a cave somewhere in Mongolia not to hear about it.
Right. Well, absolutely. In fact, I don't know if you heard this, but yesterday Zimmerman's defense attorney made sort of a I would say a callous joke even to that in that regard in his opening statements. He started his opening remarks in court yesterday. This is Zimmerman's defense attorney, by saying a knock knock joke. He said, "Knock knock, who's there? George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman, who? You're on the jury."
Oh gosh, that's not even funny. I mean, it's really we've come to a sad situation, I think, anyway, in our country, that the justice system is doesn't seem to be working the way it's designed to work. And you know, how do you go about changing it to make it better, to make it more just for not just those people who are getting the media attention, but the other ones that are probably committing just as heinous of crimes we never hear about.
Yeah, absolutely. The of course, the folks that I've been writing about in this book are individuals who you know, deserve the justice that they get, and are individuals who in many ways attempted to manipulate, to deliberately manipulate the system, in especially BTK. And here's another example of how justice can be manipulated. He actually used, I'm talking about Dennis Rader now, once he was finally caught in 2005, he used his sentencing hearing as an opportunity to grandstand and essentially intimidate and I would say re-victimize the families of his victims, because he very meticulously gloated about each of his crimes and what he had done, and he even went as far as to say that the victims were going to be his sex slaves in the next life. And so he was so unremorseful and so callous that he continued to want to torment the victims' families even, you know, long after the death of their loved ones.
Wow. That's hard to even think about.
It is. It is, but that's the nature of this, of the beast, and I use the beast, you know, in a descriptive way.
Yeah. Well, are there other serial killers that you have researched and are included in the book?
Oh yeah. Well, my book really consists of three parts, and the first third of the book is, I would almost call, everything that you wanted to know about serial killers but were afraid to ask. And so for people who are simply interested in serial killers and want to know what are they, what motivates them, how many are there, what can we do about it, are they treatable, are they insane, are they curable, that's what the first third of my book is about. And I go into things like criminal profiling, how these individuals are tracked and identified and apprehended by law enforcement. I go into a lot of detail to explain psychopathic personalities versus sociopathic personalities, and so it's sort of a primer, you know, on serial killers for people who are interested in these kind of things. And I debunk a lot of myths along the way that all serial killers are white, single males, loners, in their 20s or 30s, living out by themselves in the woods somewhere. That's you know, one of the myths of serial killers, which is far from the truth. So I debunk these sort of things, and that's the first third of the book. Then the middle of the book are these chapters where I discuss in detail what I've learned from specifically David Berkowitz and Dennis Rader. And I have a lot of new insights into their personalities, into their motivations, and, of course, their lives today. And they also gave me a lot of commentary on why they believe people are fascinated with serial killers and why people were fascinated with them. And then the last third of my book, the last part of my book, really is an analysis, a sociological analysis of society's interest in these individuals and what drives it, how various groups are involved, how law enforcement is involved in portraying these individuals as sort of larger-than-life mythical monsters, how the media adds fuel to the flame and contributes to that, how the public is involved, and how the serial killers themselves are involved. And because they are. Many serial killers are actively involved in their own celebrity status and creating headlines for themselves, as you know, was the case with BTK and Berkowitz. But they were not alone. Ted Bundy loved his headlines. The Boston Strangler loved his headlines. The Zodiac Killer loved his headlines. So they're not alone in that regard. John Wayne Gacy, Ed Kemper, on and on. So that narcissism is somewhat of a common factor. And to answer your question, Delilah, I have a lot of anecdotes and profiles and excerpts about various serial killers throughout my book, many of them to add color commentary and to, you know, to fill out my analysis.
Well, I for one can't wait to read it. You know, you and I have been working together for quite some time, and I knew and you know, in the background you were working on this, so I'm totally fascinated with the whole concept of the book, and I can't wait to get my hands on it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's coming along great. I hope to have a manuscript, the full manuscript, by the end of the summer, so it's coming along.
That's good to hear. It's our host, Kim, are you still there in the background, Ms. Crokey?
Yes, I am. Well, we have about 12 minutes to go. And, we've just covered the gamut here. This Dennis Rader, though, he is just, I mean, he was married, he was a family man. That just, when his story came out, when they finally caught him, and we found out that he had a wife and children, and nobody had a clue, just really freaked me out. What kind of correspondence are you getting from him? Although you did say that he, of course, thinks the most important person is himself.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me describe his environment, which is drastically different than that of David Berkowitz. First of all, David Berkowitz has been in prison since 1977, so he's been in for a long time. Rader was only caught in 2005, and yet his first murder was in 1974, so he was on the loose for a very, very long time. And in fact, the only reason that he was caught, it had nothing to do with expert policing. Dennis Rader was caught because of his own narcissism, and his Achilles heel became was his ego, his overly inflated ego. He had not killed for a number of years. He had gone dormant, and in 2004. After 13 years, literally he had not killed for 13 years, the local press and television in Wichita, Kansas, began speculating that he was dead, that the BTK killer was dead or had moved away or had been captured. Dennis Rader's ego could not allow that, and he had to straighten people out. So he began sending letters to law enforcement. He began sending clues and personal items from his victims to demonstrate that he, in fact, was BTK and that he was still alive and well. And by the way, he was preparing for his next victim. He said, I haven't killed for a while. I miss it. It's time to get busy again. So he began to terrorize the city of Wichita once again 13 years later. Now, the way he was caught is he began corresponding with one of the homicide lieutenants or the chief investigator on the BTK case. And he actually asked this individual, can I send you a floppy disk because there's some information I want to send you and without being able to trace it to a particular computer. And Rader is not that computer savvy, apparently. And so the police lieutenant, of course, he said, oh, no, we can't possibly trace that. And so the floppy disk arrives in the mail. They immediately traced it to the church, the Lutheran church, where Dennis Rader was the president of the council, the church council, and the president of the church association. Mm. And when he was caught, when he was ultimately caught, Dennis Rader was mortified that the police lieutenant would lie to him. He said, we had a relationship. I can't imagine that you would possibly lie to me. And of course the detective said, I was trying to catch you. You're a psychopathic serial killer. Of course I would lie to you. So Dennis, in his mind, in his grandiosity, he can't imagine that they would have lied to him. Gives you a little bit of an insight into his thinking, and so Dennis is now safely tucked away in solitary confinement in El Dorado, Kansas, and he is in a 23-hour lockdown. Literally, like where they would keep the Unabomber or a terrorist. So he's not going anywhere, and he has absolutely no contact whatsoever with other inmates, partially for his own good and partially because he doesn't play nicely with others. And he 5 hours a week, he is allowed out into the courtyard or to take a shower and get a little bit of exercise. Aside from that, he's in complete lockdown. And this is a guy who is completely unremorseful. He considers himself to be a natural-born killer, and he likens himself to a snake or a scorpion, and his logic in his mind is you wouldn't blame a snake or a scorpion for killing, so why would you blame me? I'm a natural-born killer just the way that they are. So he is able to compartmentalize his killing. He's able to compartmentalize it, and when he was BTK, that was simply in a different room in the house, to use the analogy, than the room in the house where he was the father, Boy Scout leader, business owner, civic leader, church leader. That happened in a different area of the house.
Mm-hmm. And I just have to wonder about his wife. I'm sure she divorced him. And his
children. She did
children.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Well, Paula,
go ahead.
I was going to say his ex-wife, Paula, immediately divorced him, and the normal stay on divorce the judge waived because of the extreme circumstances of it, and she is now in seclusion. She's faded away, as we as one might expect.
Oh, I'm
and,
sure.
And mm-hmm. rightfully so. She has said that the only clue, she lived with this man for almost 35 years, and she said the only clue to his personality or what he might have been doing in that alter ego called BTK was the fact that he had a box in the basement that was locked up. And in that treasure chest, which is literally what it was, and Dennis called it the mother lode, is where he kept all of his secrets and his paraphernalia and artifacts and mementos and trophies from his crimes. And he would relive his crimes with the aid of those trophies and through autoerotic fantasy and stimulation, he would satisfy himself and relive his crimes. And that is how he was able for years and years at a time to actually curb his desire to kill. And so that was her only indication, the fact that there was this box in the basement that she wasn't allowed to go near. No one was allowed to go near his trophy chest, which she found a bit, you know, a bit odd. She had no idea what was in it, of course. Little could she possibly know, or anyone. He has a daughter as well, an adult daughter who has nothing to do with him. But his adult son, I understand, does come to visit him from time to time. And one can only imagine how difficult it is for that, you know, young man to, you know, to be the son of BPK.
Oh, very difficult. Oh my gosh, I can't imagine.
I just wonder how many people like him are out there that are our next door neighbors and we don't even know it. That's what kind of scary to me.
Well, the good, if there is any good news in any of this, that serial killers are a much more rare and exotic life form than is typically realized. And I talk about this in one of the chapters in my book. The if you ask the average person on the street how many killings each year, what percentage of all homicides are committed by serial killers? And oftentimes people will say 25%, sometimes even more. Well, the reality is that serial killers are responsible for no more than 1% of all homicides in the U.S. annually. And that's a very steady and consistent number. So what they get is an undue amount of press and publicity. And so we think that they're responsible for much more of the homicide problem in this country than they are. And so not to say that their crimes aren't horrible and that they aren't serious threats, but they're simply not representative of nearly as much of the homicide equation as many people think.
Wow. Well, Professor Bond, it has been such a pleasure having you tonight, and I just want to tell our listening audience that about your website, and that is www.docbond.com. And on Twitter, you can be found at docbond. And don't forget the book, Why We Love Serial Killers, will be published next summer in 2014 by Skyhorse Press. And again, thank you so much for coming on. You're just absolutely fascinating. I so appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for so much for having me on. And it's great chatting with you and Delilah. And
yes.
I wish all your listeners a good day. And I hope you feel better, Kim. I hope you get take care of that cold.
Oh, me too. And same for you. And Delilah, thank you so much for co-hosting with me tonight. I really
always
appreciate
a pleasure.
It.
It was a lot of
you
fun.
You know, I love you.
Always.
Yep.
Love you too.
Okay. Okay. Well, and thank you for our audience tonight, our folks in the chat room. And, you know, remember that, of course, cocktails and hors d'oeuvres will be served in the chat room right after the show. So, good night. And God bless. Thank you for joining us. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye, Dee.
Bye.